This is an Awakening Zone presentation, Human Empowerment Radio and Media for the 21st Century and Beyond.
Hello, and thank you to Science This Age Radio, where the science meets the soul. We're a part of Science This Age magazine, where each month we explore in-depth different issues, and one of our last issues was on the mysteries of water. Today we have two wonderful and distinguished guests. One is Dr. Emoto, and one is Gerald Pollack. Both are sensational authors, researchers, and innovative thinkers, and I thank them for joining me today on my first show. Dr. Emoto, again, has been gained worldwide acclaim through his groundbreaking research and discovery, the water, and he's deeply concerned with our connection for individuals and to our collective consciousness and how it all goes together. He's a best-selling author of the book, Messages of Water, The Hidden Messages in Water, The True Power of Water, Love Thyself and Thy Mysteries That Water Holds. He is a longtime advocate for peace and in relationship to water. So we're going to start, and then I'm going to introduce Jerry a little bit later, because Gerald Pollack is also a world-renowned expert and an award-winning author and journal writer for a water journal. He is extraordinary as well. He's going to be in the beginning half, sort of. He can chime in anytime he wants and ask questions, which I think is awesome. And but we're going to start with Dr. Emoto, and we're going to say this. Dr. Emoto has received his certificate in alternative medicine, where after that he began and he was introduced to the study of clustered water and magnetic resonant analyst technology. And from there, I think that's where he got his big aha and his love for what began to unfold with all of his studies. So if he can kind of, Dr. Emoto, if you can give us some understanding of where and how this brought you to where your studies were.
とか今の研究をどのように始められたか説明していただけますか。
I first met with water in 1987 in California. Dr. Lee H. Lorenzen was my friend.He introduced me the special water named microclustered water. And that water has a very, very nice function or ability to memorize information and convey. So, since that, I use that water.As a, you know, homeopathy remedy. Okay?
Mm-hmm. And when you were studying and looking at the water, you noticed it had a certain structure.
No, 水を研究されている中、ある構造に気づかれたんですね。
Yes, it must be...Hexagon. Mm. そのクラスターじゃないな、は六角形であるべきであるという、そういうことに気がつきました。
I noticed that the water, the crystal should be a hexagonal shape.
And what I've discovered.
それが六角形である場合は良い水。そうでない場合には人間にとって良くない水であるということを長年の研究で、理解をしました。
I understood over years of research that good water, that pure water, should form a hexagonal crystal structure.
And the question that I have is the one thing I've learned in doing the magazine is these hexagonal structures seem to have an electrical charge component that goes with it.Is that true?
六角形の構造はにはその、ある電荷がそのチャージがあるということと思うんですがいかがでしょうか。
サイズ
あの、あるこうチャージが、あの、電荷のプラスマイナスのチャージがありますか？
ちょっと質問の意味がわかりません。
He said he's not understanding this. Can you repeat the question?
Yeah, what I've noticed is that when I look at hexagonal shape, which has the 6 points, that sort of structure is the same weight we do wiring. It's the same in a spiritual sense as the Merkaba body, which is 6. It is also an electrical charge discharge with the 6, is what I've noticed. So it seems that the information has a charge to it, creating a certain filamental structure, I would say.
Can I chime in to make,
yeah,
to make it clear? The question is does this hexagonal water have charge, or is it neutral?
その六角形の水にチャージが、あの、電荷がありますか、それともニュートラルですか？
あの、僕は科学者じゃないということは皆さんに伝えてくださいね。私はアーティストですから。
Dr. Yamamoto would like to just like to clarify that he is not a scientist. He is an artist.
Ah.
ですので、そういう質問ばかりだと、そろそろ私は帰りますよ。
And he's not as able to answer the scientific questions. They're not as interested in dealing with the scientific questions.
Ah, then so, you know what? Let me ask. Let me refer that one back to Gerald for a second, then.
Okay.
Sure.
Yeah. So, thank you. I was going to wait for a while, but let me chime in.
I just couldn't help myself.
Well, we've been studying water in the laboratory, and we discovered what we think is a fourth phase of water. And this phase is hexagonal, exactly the same as Dr. Emoto is talking about. And I think we have good evidence for this. It turns out that this phase of water, if you will, is indeed charged. And we found out also that it has the kind of structure that could easily incorporate information. So I guess that answers your question, at least from the point of view of somebody who's studying water in the laboratory. But I'll let you continue with Dr. Emoto.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Jerry, because I think that goes back to the idea that literally thought forms that are charged thoughts are mirrored in that way. Are mirrored in the water. Would that be something that would be a right question?
あの、水の中に思考が、あの、思いが含まれていること、あの、と思いますが、あの、どうでしょうか？いかがでしょうか？
水が人の意識に非常に、影響される、反応するということは、もう何万回かの実験で、そう思います。
Water is affected by human consciousness, reacts to human consciousness. That is what I've found over the course of doing many, many experiments.
Well, part of his research was in magnetic resonance analysis, which talks about the resonance and what he must be seeing. What I understand would be the patterns that emerge from vibration. Is that true?
あの、江本先生の研究は MRI をあの、magnetic resonance imaging をあの、使っていると思いますが、あの、その、そこでこう見られているその形はあの、波動の結果でしょうか？
それはちょっと情報が間違いですね。私は MRI というものは使っていません。
はい。He is not using magnetic resonance.
私が使っているのは MRA という、いわゆる、まあ、波動測定器で、何て言うんでしょうね、ラジオニクスの系統の波動測定器でありました。
He uses a magnetic resonance analysis, the MRA, in order to measure the effects of vibration on water.
And is that Dr. Constantine? I think he's come with you a few times as Dr. Emoto travels the world sampling water from many different places. What can you tell us about that?
About the water?
About the water. He's traveled all over the world analyzing waters from many different countries. And for a purpose, there must be he can see that different cultures must have different ideas, different resonance.
世界中旅されて世界中の水をこう分析した中でどのようなその文化によって水に影響がありますか？
もちろん、大きな町になればなるほど大都市ですね、東京とかニューヨークとかロサンゼルスとかロンドンとかパリとかというところの、水道水ですね、これはすべて、六角形を作らなかったという事実があります。
The large urban areas, Tokyo, New York, London, the big cities of the world, their tap water does not form the hexagonal structure.
大きな町で一番きれいな水道水を持っているのはオーストリアのビエンナ、ウィーンですね。
The city, the urban area that has the cleanest water, or the water that forms the most beautiful structure, is Vienna in Austria.
ウィーンが音楽の街と言われておりますが、バイブレーション、振動と水というのは非常に関係があるものですから、良い音楽を街の中にいつも流れているところは良い水になるということも言えるかもしれません。
I believe that it's related to the fact that Vienna is a musical, very musical city, the city of music, and that there's always music playing in the city, and that the vibration of the music affects the water in a positive way.
I think that goes back to his whole, some of the ideas he has for, I would call them healing solutions, to be quite honest. And one of them was music, prayer. He's also talked about some of the photographs he has with dolphins. Can he give us some idea what that's about?
No, それは Emoto 先生が教えてくださるそのヒーリングにつながると思うんですが、イルカの写真について何か教えていただけますか？
イルカの写真の上に蒸留水を24時間置きまして、その写真から出ている情報を水に吸収させまして、でそれで、氷結させて、で結晶写真を撮ったところ、非常に美しい、六角形を作ったのみならず、真ん中の方にはイルカが集団でシンクロナイズスイミングを踊っているようなデザインが現れました。
あ、そうですか。They put some water on a photograph of a dolphin, later took the water and froze it and photographed the frozen water.And they found that it formed a very beautiful hexagonal structure, and that in the center of it, it looked as though it almost looked as though there were dolphins swimming in the center, the pattern that was formed.
Oh, that's beautiful. There's a gentleman that in April will be on the show. His name is John Stuart Reed, and he's taken pictures of dolphins in their water as their bubbles. And if he slices the bubbles in half, he sees the resonance of the vibration, and he feels that's the way that they actually communicate. So when I think of Dr. Emoto's work and the way we are communicating soul to soul, or even city to city, or people to, people the planet, we are all these, we're all basically our own resonant container, where we seem like, from what I'm understanding from Dr. Emoto, our vibrations and our words are imprinted in our body. We our water acts like a liquid tape recorder, a transducer, and a receiver, in a sense. So we are actually projecting out within our own vibrational resonant chamber, which is our own body, our own our own signature, you might say. So, you know, I know he's concerned with some of the things that have happened with the disaster in Japan with the nuclear explosion, and he had some messages he wanted to convey to the world regarding that.
福島の事故について あの、何かこうメッセージを伝えていただけますか?
このラジエーションの問題をまたこの日本から発してしまったことについてまず世界の皆様にお詫びをしなければならないと思います。
I feel that we have to apologize for spreading radiation around the world.
そして、これがどんどんといろいろな地域に波及しないように、私はそれを阻止するための企画を考えました。
I thought of ways to stop the spread of the radiation to different regions.
3月11日午後2時46分ですね。 このハワイのビッグアイランドで私は地元の人たちを集めて太平洋の水に謝るそして感謝する愛するというようなセレモニーをリード地元のシャーマンの方と一緒にリードさせてもらいます。
On March 11th, at exactly 2:06 the time, of the earthquake, I'm planning to conduct a ceremony with shamans here on Hawaii, apologizing to the water, giving our apologies, our sincere apologies to the water.
そして同時にそれは日本の太平洋側のところでもたくさんの人が集まってやっていただくように
At the same time, I have other people in Japan and other parts of the world who will be doing the same thing in their regions to tell the water that we are for polluting it.
まだに2、3人ぐらいの方々が行方不明ということは津波による行方不明ですが。 そういうことは太平洋のどこかにまだ彷徨っておられるわけですが、彼らの御霊を安らげるために祈り、御霊が安らぐと体は上がってくるはずなんですね。そうしまして、実際に発見されてお家に戻れるというふうに私は思っておりますので、 そういったことも含めて一生懸命お祈りを捧げたいと思っています。
We're also planning to pray for there are two or three people who were never found, their bodies were never found after being washed away by the tsunami. Plan to pray for them, and in that case, we believe that their bodies will show up and be able to be returned to their families.
There's something else. Go ahead. 放射能の対策につきましては、私は愛と感謝という一つの思い、愛というのは陰陽の陽のエネルギーですね。そして感謝というのはそれを受ける方ですから、陰の方のエネルギーですね。 このエネルギーを人々がたくさん持つことによってこれは避けられるというふうに考えておりまして、それを人々に今一生懸命伝えているところであります。
I believe that we can stop the accumulation of the radiation in people's bodies by using love and gratitude being like the opposite polarities of yin and yang. The love of being the yang and the gratitude being the more receptive yin side of the equation, and that by strongly feeling those emotions, we can prevent the accumulation of radiation.
If I remember right, he, in the last magazine with, that we did on water, he mentioned that he had some solutions for the children that he wanted people to sort of purchase, because by putting words on vials, and that you could do some healing. Can you tell us a little more about that?
あの、子供たちを癒すっていうか、ヒーリングの解決として、その水に言葉を、こう、あの、言霊をこう、含めて、こう、子供たちに与えるっていうような解決策を、あの、江本先生が、あの、提供されてると思うんですが、あの、それについて少し、あの、お話をしていただけますか？
あの、そのようなスピリチュアルな方法を信用できない人もたくさんいますから、別の方法と2つの方法で子どもたちに対しての水の問題を考えています。
There are many people who cannot accept this kind of a solution. So I am thinking of two different possible solutions for healing children.
一つは、二十数年前に起きましたチェルノブイリの事件の時に、ロシアの科学者がたくさん水の研究をいたしました。ある、地区が、大変の水が汚染されなかったと、放射能の汚染されなかったというような事実があったものですから、科学者たちがそれはなぜなんだろうということで、調査をしたことがありました。まず訳してください。
One comes from the Chernobyl nuclear accident where scientists found that in one particular area the water was not polluted from the radiation, and they did many experiments to try and figure out why this one particular area was not affected.
で、そのうちの一人の科学者の方がその研究をソビエトがロシアになってからもずっと続けまして、その後アメリカの方に移住したわけですが、その水の作り方、科学的にこれを作る方法を考えて特許を得るに至りました。
So one of those scientists continued his research over many years, through the end of the Soviet Union into the Russia years, and ended up moving to the United States and continuing. And he figured out how to manufacture water with these properties, and he ended up getting his work patented.
で、その水をはすなわち、放射能の波動が入ってもそれを、まあ、中和をするような能力を持っている水なんですが、その水を今私は福島の子どもたちに対して無償でできる限り、お配りをしています。
So this particular water has the ability to neutralize the effects of radiation, and I am now giving this water, providing this water to the children of Fukushima, and as to the extent that is possible, I'm trying to do it for no charge.
Okay, oh. I'm going to ask a question. I'm going to bridge it between Gerald Pollack, and I'm going to go back and ask Jerry a question, because I think it goes back to the notion of the shaman. And in the ancient times, they knew that water was alive. There has been a study, I think it came out of Germany, Jerry, where the guys were studying the water bridge. Do you remember?
Go ahead.
But I was thinking, you know, it actually leaps from one beacon to the other.
I'm not sure of your question. Could you try
one more time? There's in the last issue of The Water, you gave me the reference to the gentleman who showed the basically the water alive, jumping from one beacon to the next. In so doing, I'm thinking that it's suggesting that once water has a life of its own, because how else does it travel?
Well, okay. This is a bit different. This is actually a 100-year-old demonstration that was, you might say, reactivated by Elmar Fuchs and a few people. What they do is they have two beakers of water sitting right next to each other. The lips are touching, and he puts two electrodes, one in each beaker of water, turns on the high voltage. And then the water jumps and makes a bridge between one beaker and the other, jumping over the two lips. Then, if you separate the two beakers, what happens is this bridge actually doesn't collapse. It sustains itself, and you can extend the distance between the lips of the two beakers up to 3-4 centimeters. And as long as you're applying this high voltage, this bridge it sustains itself. It doesn't collapse. In fact, it has almost no droop to it. It looks stiff. It looks as though it's a bridge over which you might even be able to walk. So I'm not sure if the people using the bridge might consider it to be live, so to speak. I think their interpretation is that somehow the water is jumping from the positive to the negative, or negative to the positive, and this is somehow sustaining itself by some physical reasons. Now, that doesn't necessarily imply that other kinds of energy might come in to help sustain the bridge, but I think that's not exactly what the people are thinking. Now, whether it's live is another issue. Maybe we could come back to the issue of live when we start talking a bit later about the book that I've just written, because
yeah.
I think there is something to it. Okay?
Well, it sees, because when I see the pictures between the water bridge, what's really interesting is you see these patterns, these swirling patterns, and when it gets to the center of the line, there's literally a charge happening in there. And when I did email and talk to the gentleman, he did say off the record, you know, we think it's kind of like alive. And so, you know, but you know, it's like your book, you said, Jerry. It's like, you know, where does science begin and end, and what makes some people comfortable, right?
Absolutely.
And so it's like, you know, like you say, new science is a risky business.
Oh, new science is definitely a risky business. You'd think that the scientists out there would look happily on new ideas and new concepts and such, but actually the reverse is usually true, that anything that challenges the current wisdom is in fact not generally received with an open and warm embrace. I think what happens is often the new ideas, Emoto's ideas, sometimes they threaten people, and those people have a tendency to react accordingly. And so it's been really difficult for many people with alternative views on almost anything in science to really gain a strong foothold. It's I think, a serious problem that's holding back progress in science.
It also, it seems like it's holding back the progress of the understanding of the self. Because, I mean, between, you know, doing that whole issue on water where I took it from A to Z, it is really clear that we are a resonant energy. We vibrate. Water carries the charge through our bodies, through the cells, and through many different things. And it actually creates an information data. And so what Dr. Emoto's doing is absolutely profound in the understanding, when you see, you know, the difference between when you have an anger word and how it literally becomes deformed, and when you have something beautiful like love, it actually crystallizes into these amazing, beautiful patterns that, again, that's really what you're sending out to the world. So when we do think negative thoughts, we actually are emitting literally a vibration with it. You wonder why you like some people and you don't like some people. And Jerry, that goes back to the one thing in your book, likes, likes, likes.
Oh, yeah.
You find those resonant fields. I love that part in your book, right? Because everything that you have a lot to do with water resonates with us, because we're 70% water or more. And so we're carrying the same sort of elemental characteristics of water within our own nature.
Right. Those 2 points you mentioned are really important. The amount of water that we carry, and of course, therefore, the information capacity, if indeed the information is stored in water, for which there's a lot of evidence dating back 100 years, so it seems fairly clear. But one thing people don't realize, you know, everybody knows, well, you and I and Emoto and his translator, we're all two-thirds water, right? But when you take that two-thirds and try to translate that two-thirds into the fraction of molecules of water that we are, it turns out to be 99%. In other words, of all the molecules, 99%, because the molecule is so small, and most of the other molecules are very large. So if you count all the molecules in your body and you tally them up, 99% of them are water. Now, modern biology, medicine, what have you, generally thinks of water as not so important. If you read a standard book on biochemistry or what, you find that water is merely the background carrier of the more important molecules of life. For example, the carrier of proteins, carrier of DNA and RNA and such. But it doesn't really do very much. Well, I think that's wrong. I think Emoto's work shows very nicely how wrong that is. And our own work, I don't know if it's time to phase in a little bit, but...
We can. We'll go back and forth a little bit.
Okay. So we've been doing research at University of Washington on water, and we got into this experimentally about 10 years ago, and we found something astonishing. We found that most of us have been brought up on the idea that water has three phases, a solid, liquid, and vapor, but we found a fourth phase. We found a phase that actually had been expected for over a century, but nobody had really ever identified it. We found a fourth phase, which we call, for historical reasons, exclusion zone, or EZ for short, EZ water. It's a fourth phase that lies in between solids and liquid water. And there's a lot of it. We found that there's a lot. We found also, with respect to the previous discussion, that it's hexagonal. That this is exactly the hexagonal water that Dr. Emoto has been talking about. And we found what I think is clear evidence for that. And that's discussed in the book. The evidence is discussed in terms that I think can be understood by the average lay person. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to get this stuff. It's really pretty straightforward. So there's a fourth phase. It's hexagonal. What's most interesting is that what builds this phase of water, and by the way, I should say, all your cells are filled with this kind of water. This is the kind of water that sits at protein or RNA DNA interfaces, and there's such a large matrix of these interfaces in the cell that practically all of the water in your cells are this kind of EZ or fourth phase of water. And so what's interesting about it is that it's built by external energy. It's built by light. Now, what I mean by light, pardon me?
No, I'm. There's something in my mind's going on with ideas for that. So go ahead.
No, I know your mind is full of good ideas. Okay, so but when I, as you know, light is there's an electromagnetic spectrum of radiant energy, and light is one small segment of that. It's what we can see. But there's also many other wavelengths that fill the electromagnetic spectrum. So, for example, longer wavelengths, longer than the visible range, is infrared, and shorter is ultraviolet. Well, we found that almost all of these energies are absorbed by the water, and they tend to build this fourth phase. So the more energy you have coming in, the more this phase is built. And so the music of Vienna, I think, can easily reach the water and build this fourth phase or so-called information-carrying phase. It makes total sense to me. Of course, we haven't studied exactly all wavelengths that are played by the Vienna Philharmonic or the Chamber Orchestra, but I bet that they're the right wavelengths for building. So I think there's a lot to be said about water, about its fourth phase, and about the energy that comes from outside in order to build this phase, and the phase may indeed carry information. So shall I continue about the likes, or do you want to move on to something?
I want to go back to the light part for a second, because that's something that even in the current issue that's not out, it'll be out today, it has to do with all of these different scientists from Bill Tiller, and there's another group of people from Toronto you visited their place that are talking about ethers is water. And ethers carries the charge. And then if you look at with Constantine's work, where that's one thing I had asked Constantine, is light therefore the information, this is my question, is light for the information carried in the water, the charge that's the resonance that we are all transmitting?
Well, I think the nature of light is unclear. The physics books will tell you about the nature of light, or the nature of electromagnetic waves. And that's useful. I'm not so sure that everything about that is completely understood. And this is perhaps not the time to go into the physics of electromagnetic waves, but a lot of people find it difficult to understand what's really going on, and I think it's time actually to step back and take a look at the ideas and theories that we've long held, and to see whether indeed everything is okay, or there might be some modifications that we need to impose. So it's a hard question. What you have is a hard question to answer. But
here goes back, Jerry. Here's one other thing, because this is something that's in the magazine that I thought was intriguing, and you said is verified. It is proven that there are three elements that create life. You remember that?
Please refresh me.
they basically said if you shake them up, all you needed was particles, light, and water, and life somehow mysteriously seems to create its, I'm going to say, its hexagonal structures, or its structures, which we call, you know, the in the periodic table, all of it, we measure all these different structures.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. What you need for life is you need particles, water, and light. And the reason I think that's true is, you know, if you go back to the origin of life, and I'm beginning to feel that I'm old enough that I was almost back then, that is a long time ago. Okay, so what happened? Well, obviously nobody knows, but you can conjecture. So one conjecture is that spread over the entire Earth were some molecules or particles or what have you, but not organized in any way, and water. Okay, so you have those two, and now add light. So we know what happens when you add light. What happens is, as you mentioned, the likes, mechanism. So what's like, likes, like? Well, you know, if you have two like-charged particles, let's say they're both negatively charged, everybody knows that two negatively charged particles will repel and move away from one another. The paradox is that in water, they actually move toward one another. It has been known. This has been known for a century, starting with the famous scientist Irving Langmuir, for whom a physical chemical journal is named, and then the legendary Richard Feynman, the Nobel laureate, who every physics graduate student reads his lectures, and he said the reason this happens, he calls it like, likes, like. So the two like-charged, negatively or positively, like-charged entities, particles, molecules, whatever, move toward one another. And he said the reason this happens is because of an intermediate of unlikes. So, in other words, you have two like charge, and then in the middle of that, you put some unlike charge, and this unlike charge draws the two other charges toward it. Right. So for example, you have two negatively charged particles. You put positive charges in between them, and the positive draws the two negatives, so they come closer together. So like likes like because of an intermediate of unlikes. So that's the like likes like principle. And I think it's true, and we have experiments in the lab that absolutely demonstrate it, and perhaps I think probably the listeners don't know Professor Norio Isef from Kyoto University, who actually verified it theoretically and experimentally so many times, and as a result he received the highest Japanese scientific honor, which is dinner with the emperor. And I heard the food was good and the conversation was even better. So anyway... So it looks like if you go back to the origin of life, you know, you have molecules of, let's say, the same charge and type that are spread all over, and water, and you add light, and these particles will come together by the like principle. And as they come together, then you form a kind of a colloidal or gelatinous mass, that could be the predecessor of all life. All you need to do this is light, particles, and water. And so I think that this provides a possible and reasonable explanation for how life originated. And if it's true, if that's really all you need, then you can imagine the possibility that it was not a one-time event that created life, but actually the first step in the origin of life could be happening all around us even today, right now.
When I think of what you're saying, and I take it back to, you know, even Dr. Emoto's work, and I think of from the micro to the macro. So you look at the cell; it's happening there. It's happening to the bigger part of our body. It's happening on our planet. And why can't we extend that out to the universe? Because isn't just what I understand these little particles is just bigger energy to a bigger, more massive energy. I mean, isn't that what they are, just little clusters getting bigger and bigger and bigger with the same sort of principles happening? As Hermes used to say, as above, so below?
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. It's also, I think philosophically it's beautiful because everything is attracting everything else.
I was thinking of that because even us as beings are even attracted to be on this planet. There's a resonance here. We're attracted to being in certain cities and cultures. So when I think of Dr. Emoto's work, it seems like, you know, and I think of your work on water, there's those easy zones that create division. So there's even places where there's gaps in between. So you have cities, and then there's spaces, and then there's more little towns and spaces. And then we're either born into like a country like a Japan or a States or Russia, and there's still a resonance there.
Yeah, absolutely. Perhaps, Misaro, you would like to comment on that. I think this kind of resonance is more in your realm than perhaps in my realm.
Is he there?
Sorry, I think I need to explain that. Can you clarify the question for me?
I think we're talking about the notion of resonance on the planet, and that we're, okay, as beings of resonance, we are basically attracted to different places on the planet based on our own resonance, is like Gerald Paulo's work, like, likes, like.
Okay, so... resonance っていうことについてですが、例えば、ある人がある国に、こう、惹かれて、その国に生まれてくるとか、その国に住むとか、っていうこと、について、ちょっと、こう、ご意見を聞きたい、ということです。そういう、そういうものは、
その意味は、はい、の意味はわからない。
あ、そうですね。その、あるところに、その、共鳴するということです。ですが、こう地球のこう特定な場所にその惹かれて人間が例えば
そういうね、
はい、はい、今ホワイトにいらっしゃる、はい、
生まれたところの水というものを最初に、飲んだ水というものの振動は覚えている と思いますね。
はいはい。
ですから、うん、どこに離れていってもそのような振動のある水環境に近づく、なんか、ふるさとに帰ったような気がするなと。
あ、まあ、はい、
それはあるでしょう。
あの、he says that, for example, you're born in a certain place and you drink the water and it has a certain vibration. Your body takes in that water and so it has kind of a sense of home. A water with that same or similar vibration will feel kind of like a place that has that water will feel like home to someone.
That makes sense to me.
You will resonate. Water, with water that has a similar vibration to the one that you drank when you were small, when you were first born.
That goes back to the notion that water carries the story. And mm-hmm. the one thing that was coming to my mind was that we use many technologies that use crystals, and crystals are used as I said before, liquid tape recorders, transducers, and receivers. And when you think of what you know. Gerald Pollack is saying is that the Earth, if we're made basically 99% of particles, I bet the Earth is exactly the same, but it's supposed to be 90% crystallized structured at its core, which means to me that, you know, Mother Earth also carries a record, you know, of our messages, our field. It has its own, and everybody's carrying their own story of sorts, which I think is kind of...
Yeah, I wasn't aware.
That was my
about...
idea.
Yeah, about this 90% crystal. Do you know where that idea came from?
I've read it in quite a few books, and I actually asked Howard Martin one time, who's from HeartMath. I said, isn't that not true, Howard? He goes, yeah. And I said, well, then why wouldn't the Earth, therefore, be itself charged and alive? It's mostly the same percentage of water as we are as humans. And as Dr. Emoto says, we're going to test the water in different places, which has its own memory. Homeopaths, what is it that there was a gentleman in France who tested one water, he put it in three different cups, gave it to three different people, and when they tested the water after the people had held it, it actually held the signature of the people that held it, and it became unique. So we do carry a unique signature.
I think that makes sense. It actually goes back to experiments done almost 100 years ago, which are the classic ones. I'm not sure if your listeners know about it. There are some Russian investigators named Gurevich, and what they did was they placed they took some onion plants, and you know the cells in the roots of these plants would divide, undergo mitosis at their own rate. However, when the plants were put next to them, it turned out that the rates of division of the cells were totally synchronized between just by putting them in proximity of one another, sort of like some women living together and the menstrual cycles tend to synchronize. He found exactly that in the plants, and he called this mitogenic radiation because apparently there was some kind of radiation or information that was going from one plant to the other plant, and they also thought that the water must somehow be involved, that the waters were communicating with one another in some kind of resonance, receiving signals from one sent to the other, and that was the basis for synchronization. So I think there's evidence dating way back, objective scientific evidence, and increasing toward the future that there are these signals, that the signals are somehow stored in water, and this is essential for life. May I just mention the idea of that water is living. So this started, as far as I know, with Victor Schauberger, also from, we were talking about Austria. Schauberger knew what there was to know about water. He was a naturalist, and he studied all aspects of water. And he was, to my understanding, the first person to coin the term living water. And he referred to this living water as, for example, water that was flowing in a river or undergoing all kinds of mechanical vortices, oscillations, what have you, the kind of vigorous type of motions that you'd see in a fast-flowing river. And he called this living water or live water, and he contrasted it to so-called dead water, the kind of water that's sitting stagnant for a long time. And I'm not sure if he thought of these terms as literal definitions, but he used these. In fact, his book is called Living, one of his books is called Living Water. And so I think that the hexagonal water that is under discussion may, in a sense, I'm not sure if literally, at least figuratively, may correspond to living water, because this water has energy. The light or radiant energy that you put in order to create this water, it means that this water actually is imbued with that kind of energy, and it holds the energy. And we found the way it holds the energy is that it's charged, and the region just beyond it is oppositely charged. So what happens is that when the energy comes in, it splits the water molecules into a negative component and a positive component. And the negative component goes on to build this fourth phase or easy water, and the positive component lies beyond. So it's a bit like a battery. You have negative and positive, and you can actually draw current from the negative and positive, just like a battery, except that the battery is fed by the sun or fed by light. In a way, it's kind of similar to what happens in plants, where, of course, the plant, everybody knows, the plant that's sitting on your windowsill gets its energy from light. Well, I think the water is the same thing, that it gets its energy from light or electromagnetic energy. And therefore, the water, not only inside the plant, but inside a glass of water, it receives this energy, contains living water. So I think Schauberger was really onto something when he talked about living water, because some of the water, I think including the water that sits inside of ourselves, or most of that water, really can be regarded as living water. So just to end with one amusing anecdote, I gave a talk a few years ago in Saudi Arabia, and interesting place. And one of the students came to me, and he said, "You know, I think your EZ water represents the human soul." And so my first reaction is, well, and I told him, I said, "Well, I have enough problems with my unorthodox views. I don't need another problem." But as you know, in thinking about this, there is a kind of implicit message there that this water that's inside of our bodies, you could consider it something living within us, and therefore the idea that it might have some relation to a human soul, maybe it's not that far off. So anyway, I rejected this guy's idea out of hand, but I haven't forgotten what he has to say about it. Mm. It's interesting.
When you were thinking of Victor Schauberger's work, and I'm gonna it takes me into the notion of spin. And when we look at water, we look at the vortices of water, we look at the tornadoes, we look at galaxies spinning in space. And you know that when these tornadoes get to a point, it's like they get pinched at the very bottom. And we know that's kind of, to me, how I sort of almost visualize how light gets compressed, matter gets compressed into a place where we get to be dense. We kind of get compacted into this place. And everybody knows that, you know, there's that battery field that's around a body, around every living energy. And to me, it's like that's from the vacuum where it comes in, we get to be put into this dense matter. And when you look at that bridge, there's that point of light in that place where they meet, where they pinch, where there's that spark and something begins. But within that spin are all those positive and negative charges. It goes back to the ancient Asians, where they understood, as Dr. Moto said from the very beginning, the yin and the yang. So the yin and the yang to me is still the positive and the negative charges. And when you look how a river or a snake or our spine or anything works that moves energy, it's still in these positive and these negative fluxes. And to me, that almost sounds like the engine, the things that move it. That's the engine of life. And I know cells have that same sort of pump, don't they, Jerry?
Yeah, okay. Well,
am I stretching things for you?
Yeah, I there are a few things to say. So first, regarding engines of life, my previous book was called Cells, Gels, and the Engines of Life. And I think there is something there. I think... I guess from my point of view, which again is a radical point of view, it's not shared by so many people, including even some of my students in the laboratory, but I think there that charge is basically the engine of life. I think charge has been underestimated. There's charge in tornadoes when tornadoes twist and cause the havoc that they cause. You know there are charges involved because you can see lightning discharges in tornadoes. So there's got to be all kinds of huge voltages involved, and so we know that that's the case. And when you think of why the tornado has the huge winds that it has, we come back to the like principle. And if you can imagine, right in the tornado, right at the center of the tornado, you have a kind of slow twist of the tornado, not so fast, and actually in the middle of the tornado, almost nothing. But if you can imagine around the tornado, many particles, and usually these particles moving have negative charge. They acquire negative charge because they're moving through the air, and everything moving through the air acquires negative charge. So all of these massive numbers of particles twirling around are held to their neighbors. It's almost kind of almost like a solid, but it's not a solid. And so if you just take a moment. Well, like us. Okay, like us. Yeah. So,
sorry.
So if you could take the extreme and imagine this tornado as like a cheese wheel of some sort, it's all held together, and the center rotates very slowly. And if the center rotates very slowly, because it's kind of a solid, the periphery, the outside of that round of cheese, will rotate very, very fast. And that's what happens in a tornado. The huge winds are near the edge of the tornado. You're standing there, and suddenly the tornado comes, and wham, the huge speed. So two things about the tornadoes. すみません。
いや、国語の電話は私が自分の電話じゃないんで長いことやられてると迷惑をかけるんで、私にもう用がなければ去りたいんですが。はい、あの
Dr. Imago wonders if you have any final questions for him.
No, I don't. I just think everything is kind of going and creating sort of a profound acknowledgement of his work. I thank you for him for being with us. And does he have anything else he'd like to say before he'd like to go?
Ah,
私が必要なければもう人の家に迷惑をかけたくない。3月11日のね、祈りについて皆さん世界中のどこにいても祈れることでございますので、犠牲者のために、そしてまたラディエーションが世界に蔓延しないように 祈ってくださるように、再度お願いをしておきたいと思います。はい、ありがとうございます。
He would just like to ask that everyone joins in the prayer on March 11th and to prevent radiation from spreading any further, and you can join this prayer from wherever you are. So he would ask that everybody would join in.
Megan, is it online where we can go to his website and look for it? Is it listed there? 江本先生のホームページにその情報は載ってますか?
Yes, you can find the information on his website, which I have open somewhere here.
It's the official.
The official website. Yes, you should be able to find it on there.
On the official website for Dr. Imago.
Masaru/emoto.net.
Yeah, and you can find his books there, and and all the beautiful images that will clarify. If you haven't ever seen his work, definitely look up the images. They're staggeringly profound.
Hi.
あの、あと地元で被災をしてくれている一人の方の、あのアドレスを申し上げます。
はい、申し上げます。ハーモニクスライフセンターハワイ .blogspot.com でございます。長いんですが、ハーモニクスライフセンター
。ハーモニクス。
ハーモニクスライフセンター.blogspot.com。
blogspot.com, and that tells about the それはあの、その
Talking about the March 11 ceremony, worldwide simultaneous prayer for the water of the planet. I'm putting that information in my website. Is this good in English? English? I speak
yeah,
in English. So it's harmonicslifecenter.blogspot.com. Harmonics with S.harmonicslifecenter.blogspot.com. And we're going to be praying all together wherever you are in the planet. If you listen to this radio show, you can join us wherever you are when the earthquake happens, exact time, which is March 11, 2:46 p.m. Japan time. But here in Hawaii, March 10th, 7:46 p.m. Hawaii time, and you can use the time converter, time zone converter, to find your local time.
Okay.
We're going to pray for the water, for the healing, and for the health, and gratitude and love.
最後に僕に質問がありましたら、ちょうど今、僕の通訳が戻ってきたから、自由にしてください。と、ください。
If there are any other questions you have for him before he exits, he has someone there who can also help him answer.
I think I'm okay with where we're at. If there's anything else, I think we're in good shape. Thank you so much.
Okay. ありがとうございます。
はい。じゃあ、
どうも。
お疲れ様。
ありがとうございました。Thank you.
Bye.
Hello.There we go.
Karen?
Back to you. Yep,
okay,
I'm here.
Okay, I'm here.
Okay. You know, there was something in the very beginning of your book, and I kind of chuckled. It says here in the opening, you're sitting in the living room with a Nobel laureate, which is Sir Andrew Haroldly, who says, you say he's the noblest of the noblest, and yet you have a new revelation. And as many longstanding models are being challenged in many fields, you know, you're sitting there with somebody that's that world-renowned, and you have something new, you kind of mentioned that it's kind of awkward.
Well, yeah, this was in my younger days. Actually, it's Sir Andrew Huxley, H-U-X-L-E-Y, and that name around the world, and especially in England, is magical because we have his half-brother, Aldous Huxley, who famously wrote the book Brave New World, how many years ago? 50 years ago or something? And then before him was Thomas Henry Huxley, who was known as Darwin's Bulldog, famous biologist. And there were more, but Sir Andrew, the late Sir Andrew, he died this year, is the only one who actually won the Nobel Prize. And Sir Andrew has been given every honor that you can imagine besides the Nobel Prize. He was knighted by the Queen, Sir Andrew, and he was president of the Royal Society, which is the distinguished British Society of Scientists. And he was also Master of Trinity College, Cambridge, which is, of course, a high academic distinction. So this is a fellow who holds, who held every conceivable academic honor. And there was this guy, you know, who came to our laboratory to see what we had done because his theory, we were dealing at the time with the mechanism of muscle contraction. And we thought that the evidence that we had produced meant that his theory was wrong, absolutely wrong, no way. And So we came to Seattle to find out what we were doing. And we sat in the laboratory in my office and such, and we went over the data, the evidence, and we had many discussions about that. But, of course, there were social events. And so he came to my home. This was many years ago. And there I was, this young assistant professor or associate professor or whatever, who, you know, was not really terribly important in any way. And sitting next to me was this scientific aristocrat. And, you know, I was intimidated, frankly. This fellow was so important, and who was I? And to make matters worse, he was shy. It is not the kind of gregarious guy who takes the flag and waves it and talks about what have you, but he almost didn't know what to say, and I didn't know what to say. So you can imagine how awkward the situation was. We had evidence. We had three different experiments whose results absolutely flatly contradicted his theory, and his theory is in every textbook. And so we thought scientifically that we had something important, and it wasn't easy. If we had embraced his point of view, it would have been fine. You know, we'd sit down and drink beer or whatever, but it was, we were adversaries, not personal adversaries, but scientific adversaries. So it was awkward. You know, we talked about the Seattle weather and how much it rains and the sunshine, what have you, you know, what else. And finally, some other people came. What a relief. So the other people could talk to him instead of me, and that was a huge relief. But you know, it brings a larger point. So most of us, I've been in science now for more than 40 years, and I know many people, and I've been there. I've been around. So it's a bit easier. But most of us think that somebody who has won the Nobel Prize, or even someone who's important in some way, but especially winning the Nobel Prize, it's almost that these people become godlike figures, that God has anointed them to be these special people. In fact, it's a committee of five or six people who look around, look at many nominations, and you know how committees work. And so someone is chosen, and then the whole Swedish Academy will vote whether it's okay or not. I haven't been there, so I don't know whether it's just a rubber stamp or something more serious. But it's a committee, you know, and we all know how committees are. So a person who wins a Nobel Prize is shouldn't necessarily be exalted as a godlike figure. And the same thing applies. So we read a textbook. We read a textbook in physics or chemistry or what have you, and we see some of these names who have been there for six or seven generations, and we assume, because their names have been there for so many generations, that there's absolutely no question they must be right. Right. So we take, for example, Einstein, we take Maxwell, we take Newton, Niels Bohr, legendary figures in science, and because they're legendary, we automatically presume that everything they say is correct. Well, I think that's not true, and it might be true, but it might not be true. And I think it's possible that science could make far more progress if the scientists took a step back and actually asked the question, well, how sure are we that all of these principles are correct? And what most scientists do is they will go do some experiment and interpret it, and the interpretation almost always rests on these foundational considerations, which we all take as true. They're absolutely true, automatically true, and then we build onto that. So it's dangerous. It's something akin to what happened before Galileo, when everybody started building around the concept that the Earth was the center of the solar system. You know, and you could do that and interpret a lot of different things, but those orbits that you calculate become mighty complicated. But if you get the right foundational assumption that the sun is at the center, everything turns simple. Today, science is very complicated. And I think the reason it's complicated is that some of us are banking on assumptions or on theories or concepts that may not be correct. See, and I've seen much of that. I've seen in meeting a lot of people that usually there's a theory that prevails. Let's say Bernoulli's principle. Okay, some people, your listeners may not know it, but Bernoulli's principle is what is theorized to keep planes aloft. So you have an engine. The engine propels the plane forward, and Bernoulli's principle means that the pressure above the wing is lower than the pressure beneath the wing. Sounds good, and everybody uses it, and it's been around for generations, therefore it must be right. And it has critically to do with the shape of the wing, right? It's kind of rounded at the top and flat at the bottom. However, planes can fly upside down. And so if they can fly upside down, how does this work?
That
it would seem that...
Down.
And not only can they fly upside down, but we actually recently bought for some experiments a model plane. It's 1 meter or so, or a few feet, and wingspan, and made of some kind of foam. We had some ideas in mind, and they came with a series of different wing shapes from which you could choose. And they said the most popular one is the one where the shape at the top and the shape at the bottom of the wing were the same. Now, wait a second. That's not supposed to work, but it works just fine. So here we go, and if you start looking on the Internet, which I did, you'll find many people who are suggesting that something is wrong with Bernoulli's principle. Now, I don't know if they're right or not, but I'm just giving you this as an example that we reflexively invoke certain principles, like Bernoulli's principle or certain theories, even though, if we really look, we can see that there's some things that don't fit at all. So, but they persist, and I think that's the problem with science today: is that by persisting with these principles that we're not sure, we get misled into thinking certain things are true or that are not true, and we get misled into believing complicated theories that may not be right. So I'm for a revolution in science.
I know you are, and there's the funny thing you said. It says that there are many experiments that you've done with water that actually can be done on the kitchen table.
Well, yeah, the experiments we do are really simple. They usually involve nothing more than a microscope and a little chamber that you can buy like a Petri dish and some water and some material and some tiny little particles. That's how we started out in this field. I actually am an engineer by training, and sophisticated technology does have some appeal. And in my former field of muscle contraction, where we challenged Sir Andrew Huxley and such, we were known mostly for producing frontline instrumentation that could be used to probe the behavior of muscles in a way that other people couldn't do. And so we became famous for frontline technology. In the case of water, it turns out that almost all the experiments we do are so simple that anybody could do them. And I find more and more people are doing them. Just all you need is a microscope, and in some cases, actually a magnifying glass will be enough to learn quite a bit. It seems to me that that science doesn't need to depend on $100 billion colliders or a trip to toward another galaxy or something. It can be done very cheaply and simply. All that's required is a little thinking.
Well, here's a question, because it says, you know, in the book too, that the unified, you know, with what you've done, you're actually created a new lens to look through water as a way of calling it a unified field principle, in a sense, that water itself is the unifying field.
You might call it that, right? One of my colleagues has written something on the back of the book. The book, by the way, should appear. For those listeners who are interested,
yeah.
it's called The Fourth Phase of Water, and it'll appear toward the end of April. It's in print right now. It's being printed by a Korean printer. But let's see, what was I going to say? Sorry.
We do have that on the, for those who don't know that, that is on the website, so don't miss it on Awakening Zone or at Science to Sage. So go ahead.
Yeah, okay. But I was going to say something else. We were in the middle of a thought.
That's okay. It had to do with the unified field theory of how looking through the lens.
Oh, yeah. So on the back of the book, my friend Professor Martin Canny, C-A-N-N-Y, of the Australian National University, said something just like that. He wrote a very nice comment on the back. He said, at first I thought we could use physics and chemistry to understand water. What he learned from my book is that you can actually take water to understand physics and chemistry.
Yeah.
So I thought that was and I think that water is a great substrate that could be used to study nature because the very fact that it absorbs energy and it changes or transduces that energy into other kinds of energy means that it's a very nice and easily accessible system to study what happens in nature. And that's what we found. With these simple experiments, we've learned so much about how one kind of energy is absorbed and converted into another. Example, unless you have another question, I'll keep going.
The only other thing that I had, because you mentioned it also in the back of the book, is the fact that this, and you can keep going and then do that one and then this one, is the fact that this leads to new technologies. And then in some ways, when we look at the water in nature, there are things from water filters to water-based solar energy and batteries that we can create with water. I mean, there's a lot of things that when you're discovering that's going to take us forward in a way that will make energy free or cheap.
Right. Let me address that. And so first, I just want to say about the energy, the radiant energy that's being absorbed by the water. That is energy coming from light, from infrared energy, and there's infrared all over. It's being generated by the walls and by the chairs and by your computer and by yourself. If you turn off all the lights and turn on an infrared camera, you get a beautiful image, no problem. So everything around you is generating infrared energy, and this energy is especially powerful for building this fourth phase of water. So we got to thinking, if the water keeps absorbing energy, it's got to do something with that energy. It can't just keep building up. It's like blowing a balloon, you know. You put energy into it, you expand it, but you just can't keep going. It'll burst, right? So it's the same with the water. It can't just keep absorbing energy. It's got to do something. And we found that it does. So one of the undergraduate students working in the laboratory came running in one day, and he wanted to tell me something. And he had put a tube in the water. That tube was like a little straw, a piece of straw, you know, that you'd use for a drink. It was a small segment of the straw, and it was made of some so-called hydrophilic or water-loving material. So he just put this little tubule inside the water, and he looked at it in the microscope, and it's one of these kitchen table experiments. And what he noticed is that the water kept flowing through the tube. Now, this is very strange if you think about it, because usually in order to get fluid to flow through a tube, you need a pump of some sort. So you take your blood vessels, your heart is pumping the blood through your vessels, and if you cut out your heart, you won't get any flow anymore. So, but here is a case where the flow of water went persistently through the tube, almost endlessly. And so the question, of course, is, well, where's the energy come from? You can't get something for nothing. So it turns out that we found that, indeed, that the energy came from the light that was absorbed by the water. So the light comes in, and somehow it's transduced or changed into mechanical flow energy. Light energy in, flow energy out. And all this happens in the water. So this was a cool finding, because if you think about what might be happening to you, you got blood vessels, and those blood vessels are all over your body, many of them near the surface of your body, and you're receiving light all the time, either the visible light or the infrared light or ultraviolet light. And we know from the experiments, if we increase the light, we get more flow. So there's no doubt that the flow is driven by light. So the question is, is your flow driven, or at least helped to be driven, by the light that you absorb? And this is a question.
Or Jerry, could it even be the light that you are?
I mean, we do generate light. People have been making measurements of biophotons, and I look at it slightly differently. I look at it as energy comes in, energy goes out. So in the case of a plant, light energy goes in, it turns it into chemical energy, which drives the metabolism of the plant, it drives the bending of the stem, and the movements and such, and growth and what have you. It does all kinds of things, and the same with the water. Of course, the plant...
The bending of the stem... Jerry, is the bending of the stem more like it's growing spirally, like a Fibonacci's going up, like that, almost like an electrical charge current driving itself?
I think there is an electrical current, but it's... I mean, almost everything seems to be electrical. The more we study, the more we learn that it's all electrical, that separation of charge, movements of charges, it seems to drive everything.
That reminds me of radiant, radioactive, and radio.
Well,
those words having almost the synonymous meaning.
Radio. Well,
radio, radiant.
Yeah,
radioactive.
Maybe I haven't really thought of that. I just want to say that, you know, we really underestimate the role of charge. We think, you know, we don't really feel charge very much. So, like, if you walk under a 500,000 volt power transmission line, most people will feel nothing. Some people are sensitive to it and can feel it. But basically, huge charges, we don't really sense them. We haven't developed sensors. If you walk next to a power supply that may generate 30,000 volts and you put your hand near it, you feel nothing. At least most people feel nothing. Some may feel something, but it's pretty subtle. So it means that if there are charges in the neighborhood, it's really hard to, huge charges, it's really hard to sense them. And to give you some idea of the force of these charges, there was one example that I read which really astounded me. So it's so simple. You take a 120 watt light bulb and you collect all the charges, the current, you might say, all the charges that flow through the filament of the light bulb for 1 second, okay? And and you take all these charges, it's a thought experiment, and cluster them and put them on the ground, okay? And then you take another light bulb, or the same one, and you collect, again, the charges that run through the filament in 1 second, okay? And you have a second cluster, and you position the second cluster above the first cluster, let's say 3 feet apart. So you have one cluster of charge on the ground, another cluster of charge a meter or so above that. Now, you know that these are going to repel each other, right? Because they're both negative. And the question is, well, how much force do they exert? Remember, you've collected all of the charges that run through the bulb for 1 second, standard 120 watt. So I asked my class recently about this, and so one guy raised his hand and he said, well, you know, I think a kilogram, that is 2 pounds. Another one said, that's too much, I think maybe 100 grams. And a third person said, well, I'll be bold and say 2 kilograms. Okay, so, you know, 1 second's worth of charge and such through a light bulb, that's kind of what you think. But the answer, if you calculate it, I found this in a book, it's very simple to calculate it, is the amount of force would be sufficient if you put a platform resting on top of the upper cluster of charge. You can put 5,000 fully loaded Boeing 747s on it, and those charges will lift it. That's how powerful even a few charges can be. So
wow.
Charges, yeah, it's astonishing that anybody who is knows the math can do the calculation. It's really very simple. A huge amount of force that's generated. So it means that even a few charges sort of scattered around the environment can have massive power to do things. And we don't feel the charge, so we don't think about it. You know, we don't understand that charges are involved. So So I think that we've really underestimated the role of charge in everything that happens around us. Okay, very important. Okay, so
Jerry, we've got about 5 minutes left. So I just want to want to make sure that I get it. Yeah, I know it went by really fast. To make sure that we mention anything that you want to say before we go off the air, literally in 4 minutes. Also, you can come back.
Okay. Well,
because I still think there's this whole idea is amazing. I think the idea of charge. Next week we have Constantine, who has the GVD machine that measures all these electromagnetic stuff, and it goes into the conscious, subconscious, and subtle layers, and which I think are important. And so that'll be on the 19th. And
okay.
I think we could that way that part we can actually carry on the conversation. But you have this amazing book. It comes out. I did give you a double spread in the magazine with it, so that people can learn to go more. If people want to find out more about the A through Z's of water, the Science to Sage magazine, we have an issue that was 140 pages long that featured Gerald Pollack and Dr. Emoto and Maewon Ho. And Jerry's going to be in London from March 12th to the 28th. Dr. Maewon Ho is doing a water festival, which people should look out. It's also in the magazine. It's also online at Science to Sage. Do not miss that. What she's done is brought you want to say anything about it, Jerry? Because she's brought musicians and artists and conferences.
Yeah, it's any of the listeners who happen to be in London at the time, it's really worth going. She's integrating science, art, and music. It's a unique kind of festival, and many of the people who know a lot about water will be there and mixed in among the artists and the musicians and such. I guess I want to say that we're just about out of time, that anybody could get more scientific information by just looking at our website, and I won't give you the URL because it's too long, but all you need to do is look under Gerald Pollack, University of Washington, water, or any of those combinations. You'll find me easily, and there's a load of information, I think interesting information, including actually a free download of a rough draft of the book for the next few weeks until the book is ready. It's not the final version, but it's actually not too far distant from that. And
not
you can
the
get
one
a,
I got to read.
Yeah, okay, it's not too distant. I just do I have another minute or so?
Yep.
Okay, just want to say, regarding your last question about technologies, there are a couple of technologies that we're working on, and maybe the most important one is to get energy from water. See, the sun hits the water, and it separates charge into plus and minus. And so if you put two electrodes in the water, one in plus, one in minus, you can get energy from that. And that energy is very similar to the kind of energy that you get in photosynthesis. That is the first step of photosynthesis, where the sun hits the plant and the water in the plant is split into plus and minus. So it's very similar. In fact, what we have might be thought of as a kind of generic photosynthesis that we have. And the second one, we have 30 seconds? is to as a filter, because this exclusion zone excludes everything. So if you collect the exclusion zone water, you have water that's free of junk, free of bacteria and what have you. So I'll close there.
Thank you, Jerry, for your amazing work. Thank you, your team in there, for all that you do for humanity. And I know that this is, you know what, there's more. And maybe I have to back, because I know you have a really big dream. And I think I would love to bring you back at one point, and you can discuss what the next big dream is.
Okay, sure. Thank you, Karen.
All right.
It's been fun. Okay.
Oh, it's been really fun. Thanks, Jerry.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Goodbye.
You have been listening to an Awakening Zone presentation, Human Empowerment Radio and Media for the 21st Century and Beyond.